There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
It is Eye on Health with you today. I'm Suzanne Radford and Keith Littlewood's back, rehabilitation and performance coach based at Happy in Alsacal Avenue. Hello to you, Keith.
Good morning, Suzanne. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you? How was your leave?
Well, I'm a bit jaded today, I have to say. It's been running around. I was in the States studying. I was in the UK. We were on semi kind of holiday. Then we were running around to family dues. You know how it is. And then my birthday was on that time. So I got
Happy
taken
birthday.
Away for 24 hours, the third time in 4 years we've spent a night away from our kids. Not very long, but it was great nonetheless. And I had a meeting this morning at 4 o'clock in the morning on a Skype for an organization that I talk for, but it should stand me in good stead for a presentation on sleep biology that I'm giving tomorrow. So I should look the perfect example of how not to be if you don't get your sleep right.
Why 4 a.m are you having a meeting?
Well, it's an organization that I teach for, and it's the instructors mainly reside in the States or some Asian countries, and so 5 p.m. Pacific time was 4 a.m. Dubai time. So, yeah, but we'll get by. We have caffeine and orange juice, so it's good.
Well, we're lucky to have you, I think, then, clearly. But, yeah, you should know how to maintain energy levels. That's what you talk a lot about, and how to supplement your body, and what to do with your body. Funny enough, we just mentioned supplements there. We are going to be looking at supplementation. One of the things you're quite passionate about, and you see it in practice, Keith, with people that come to see you, is it's not about always reducing, it's about maybe adding. But then people can go overboard and become excessive in their exercise. Exercise is good for me, I'll start exercising every single day. That might work for you, it might not. Supplementation, vitamins, they're good for me, so I'm going to take lots of them, and that means I'll be really healthy. Water, and we should be increasing our water intake through the summer months. It's very hot out there, we need to hydrate. However, we need to be aware that we're not over consuming water, because that also can do our bodies more harm than good.
Yeah, all of those, really. I think everything that you've hit the nail on the head, and as Paracelsus once said, the dose makes the poison, which I think I've said many a time. And water, I've just started working with a client who's consuming 8 to 9 litres of water a day.
That's a lot of water.
It is, and you know, their blood pressure hasn't changed. In fact, it's been going up, and there are specific mechanisms why people's blood pressure goes up when you consume a lot of water, because you wash a lot of the sodium out. And there are a variety of other mechanisms to consider. The same with exercise. Most people who want to stay fit and healthy can do really well with 3 good training sessions a week, and then, you know, supplemented with a good walk here and there. And that's something we tend to lack, especially in the summer months out here, because the heat's so oppressive. But, you know, even I get out at night and walk around the lake once or twice around the lake, and yeah, you'll have a good sweat, but I mean, sometimes that having a bit of a sweat's good. And exercising, if you want to exercise in the heat, keep it low key. You know, you're not supposed to going out there and running the Marathon de Sable every week. Walking in the heat's going to be fine for you. And the same with nutrients and supplements. A lot of people that I tend to see are people who are trying to be really healthy, and being really healthy has a lot of issues with it, because you tend to focus on foods that are supposedly natural and wholesome, but they come with a lot of foods that actually harder to digest. They restrict the uptake of other nutrients. You know, we can see issues like sleep coming through, not sleeping as well because they don't have enough carbohydrate in the diet. And there's a bit of a fad at the moment about, say, ketogenic dieting and exclusively eating just fats and proteins, and that in essence is a stress response. If people try to eat like that for long periods of time, you're going to see issues. And again, it's coming back to the balance. And the same with supplements. We can get a lot of foods, nutrients from our foods, but some people tend to go with excess of supplements because they think more is always going to be better. And I think we've got some case studies up of coming up of why that isn't necessarily always going to be the case. And we certainly need a balance. And even we know that water in excess is poisonous. We know that oxygen in excess is poisonous. And you can apply the same things to certain vitamins, that they have a dose response where they're going to be very beneficial. But as soon as you have too little or too much, it's the same with vitamin D. There are various markers that show that when you take too much of something, it's going to cause a problem.
So we're going to be unpacking that in the first hour of the show. When you mentioned water there, so the chef, Nigella Lawson, this is coming out of the UK, she admits, "I'm an aquaholic." It emerges she's been warned over health risks of excessive water intake. She's a self-confessed aquaholic who's admitted in the past to drinking 3 litres of water before going to sleep at night. It emerged that the domestic goddess Nigella Lawser has been repeatedly warned about the health risks of her excessive water drinking by her family doctor, Peter Wheeler. The revelation from the 51-year-old TV cooks says, and from her brother as well, Dominic Lawson, says, look, following the recent criticism by Glasgow-based GP Dr. Margaret McCartney of an NHS website suggestion that people should try to drink about 6 to 8 glasses of water a day to prevent dehydration. And this is in the UK, so you wouldn't always associate that with being a hot country, but it's not always about it being hot or cold. It's just about the body needing water and us understanding the right levels. Dominic Lawson wrote in the Sunday Times that at the risk of breaking both medical and family confidences, he could reveal that Dr. Wheeler has frequently warned his sister Nigella about the risks of her health from an excessive intake of water. He went on, Nigella admits to being an alcoholic. It really is true that those who habitually drink many litres a day suffer the sensation of being thirsty, even when they're more than fully hydrated. So what's that all about? You're not feeling hydrated, so you're drinking more. The more you drink, the more thirsty you feel?
Well, you can get a condition called hyponatremia, which is basically where you have such a depletion of salt because you consume a large volume of fluid, and it potentially takes a lot of salt out when you go to the toilet. So sometimes there can be kind of contradictory mechanisms, and this is one that we can see here. So maybe that the thirst is actually, you know, when we're going to the toilet, we are washing out a lot of nutrients. So the thirst can sometimes be a request to take in other aspects of nutrients, and there are many minerals within fluids like water anyway. It seems kind of counterproductive, but that does actually happen, and it's the same thing with certain foods sometimes as well.
Well, back in 2003, Anthony Andrews, the actor, you may remember him from Brideshead Revisited, he said in a statement that he owed his life to his driver, who rushed him to hospital after he fell unconscious from the effects of drinking 8 litres of water. Mr. Andrews consumed a large quantity in a misguided attempt to counter the effects of heat and voice strain whilst he was performing on the West End stage. He passed out in his car and as he was being driven by his driver, who took him straight to the... He was 55 years of age. He returned to his London home after undergoing tests at the London Clinic in Harley Street. I mean, it's surprising, isn't it? His role was demanding and drinking water was essential. What are you doing? What you are doing is taxing your vocal cords to the maximum. So he was lubricating his vocal cords as well as staying hydrated. As you said, Keith, it says in this article, hospital staff treated Andrews for hypotrosemia. This condition caused by the dilution of sodium in the body after theatre employees reported they'd seen him drinking large amounts of water before, during and after his performance.
Yeah, one of the other common misconceptions of water is people tend to drink a lot of water because they think it stifles the hunger response. And you know, people will drink kind of 3 or 4 litres of water because they're told the more water you drink, the healthier you are. But that has a counterproductive effect on the body. And it's been shown now that even fluids like caffeine and tea don't have the diuretic effect that everybody thought they did. So we often can get quite a substantial amount of fluid from fruit, juices, teas, water, all of these kind of products. So sometimes when we then start going above 3 or 4 litres, that some people are in the heat and they're exercising, let's say if you're a professional sportsman and it's your job to do that, you're going to need to take on a certain amount of fluids, but you need the electrolytes to go with that. You know, we're talking about magnesium, sodium, calcium to a degree slightly different, but when we see cramps, for example, it's usually because we've lost quite a lot of sodium and magnesium, sometimes calcium as well, because calcium is actually quite an integral part of the muscle contraction. So these are some of the issues that we can see, and it's always, I think most people, even out here, if you're not doing too demanding a job or not exercising considerably, I think you could get away with drinking somewhere between 1 and 1.5 litres a day if you weren't going in the heat. If you're in the heat, then you could probably go a bit more. But the more that you flood yourself with water, it doesn't make you detox better. It doesn't make you do anything apart from you can then start to increase mechanisms like increasing blood pressure because you don't have enough salt in the system. The kidneys have a regulatory mechanism. Well, they'll stop you passing out more salt and other nutrients as well. So I personally think that people need to drink less, but not to the point where they're getting dehydrated. And you'll know.
And to point on that, you know, the signs of dehydration. So whether you maybe get a little headache or whether you are, they say when you're already feeling thirsty, you're already dehydrated.
Yes, yes. And, you know, there are other aspects of water. We know that water has been is used in some computers to store information. And if we think about the brain and that, and we see our cognition slow down, or we can see our performance when we're exercising slow down. But also part of that might be because we're losing nutrients as well. So we need to be mindful of not just water, but the symptoms like you allude to is, you know, increased thirst. But we just found out there that people who drink even more water, for example, will have an increased thirst as well. And we can see that in poor metabolic issues as well, like diabetic states as well.
The things we do a lot of because we think it's good for us, are they? Is it? We have a message here. For some time, I have had diarrhea-like symptoms that causes... So what would cause this? Would this be IBS is the first part of the question. So understanding what IBS is.
Well, IBS is a blanket term for sometimes for something that they don't actually know what the cause of an irritated bowel is. However, I would counter that and say there are a number of things that can create IBS-like symptoms. First of all, stress will always cause that, and there may be an emotional trigger that might drive it. Second of all, there might be something, an issue with irritation of the GI tract, most notably the intestines. Sometimes when we consume a lot of foods like nuts and seeds in particular can stimulate irritation of the bowel because they increase the level of serotonin. And serotonin, which we often kind of equate with being the kind of happy neurotransmitter, is actually mainly produced in the digestive tract, somewhere between 95% to 98%. Now, if we eat lots of food, so lots of undigested vegetables and even fiber to a degree, when we're consuming lots of fiber and seeds and stuff like this, so if you think about strawberries and raspberries and blackberries, hundreds of tiny little seeds, and seeds are nature's way of kind of saying, eat my fruit, but then do me a favor and, you know, propagate my seed, as it were. And so the idea of having seeds in the diet is that they do actually irritate the digestive tract. So there might be a number of foods that are in someone's diet that create this kind of irritating response. Some people might go and test and look at this, but this isn't something you're going to see necessarily from a food sensitivity test. But when I'm seeing issues like kind of constant loose stools and irritated stools, I'm thinking there's a trigger that drives that. And I think I've seen a lot of people where I've seen kind of 20 years of IBS like symptoms clear up by a few small tweaks to the diet. And I think you know, sometimes when there are other states, sometimes you can get parasites that might cause that. We certainly know amoebic like parasites certainly have a stress like that. But sometimes when the immune system's functioning well and the hormones are functioning well, we should actually be able to get rid of that. And there are some people, their immune system and their hormones aren't functioning as well as they could be. There are a number of environmental mechanisms, or perhaps they're just stressed out all the time. And so sometimes if this doesn't clear up, you may want to look at something like a stool test to find that out. But I would always go down the route of saying, what am I consuming in the diet that might be irritating that? And some people, believe it or not, there's a lot of emphasis on gluten sensitivity, and there are specific tests that confirm whether someone actually has an issue to gluten sensitivity. But there are perhaps also some mechanisms beyond that. I know that when the body's under a lot of stress, we actually process gluten proteins very differently, which might not actually show up in a particular test. And certainly sometimes some grains might have some other mechanisms in them that may cause someone to have an irritated bowel. So you could always try by cutting certain foods out, like grains out, and see what the response is. You know, we talked about the seeds, you could always try that as well. And also ask yourself and be quite candid with yourself, is there a particular stressor that I'm going through permanently that might cause this as well?
You know, that you say, don't you, elimination. So try, you know, whatever you think might be the cause first. So if it's seeds, or if it's grain, if it's, you know, eating bread or whatever, you're, where you're getting your grains from, try it and see how you feel and how your body responds. It could be dairy or lactose, but obviously don't cut all of it out at once, because you won't know which one is the perpetrator.
Yeah, and everybody goes on and say, grains are bad, dairy's bad, sugar's bad, this is bad. And in all honesty, nothing's really that bad, apart from, I would say, heated vegetable oils, which I would always say are probably one of the main reasons why we kind of have issues. And there's another reason right there. If you're eating a lot of fried food that comes from fried vegetable oils, that's a potent irritator of the digestive tract, and most notably the intestines. So there are some foods in there that you certainly could cut out. People tend to have a bit of a harder time with dairy because there's more damage going on in the bowel, and they lose the ability to digest dairy and particularly produce the enzyme lactase. Lactose. Yes, I am tired. Yes, can't remember the A's or the O's. If it's an enzyme, it would be an A's. You need to kind of take this in context. So you often find that people, as soon as they become aware of certain subjects, they then have that issue. And that's often not the case. Most people also look at, say, they've eaten a food and they've got bloated and they're swelling up and they're irritated. But sometimes our hormones that create balance are the reason why our digestive system isn't working that particularly well. And sometimes when we're too sympathetic dominant or parasympathetic dominant, this can create certain issues relating to the nervous system. And it's all about trying to get the balance with that. So there are a number of things that you can go through and clear to see if that's going to help out. And there's probably, I don't know, 5 or 10 things that we could do to say, okay, what happens when we try this? What happens when we try this? And you're right, don't try too many things at once because you'll get confused about what you're actually assessing.
They are asking about ginger and saying, could ginger make IBS worse?
Well, it depends is probably the answer. And for most people, there's actually quite a lot of research that shows that ginger is a softener of kind of IBS-like symptoms and digestive symptoms. And I'm not sure if that's primarily because it had an effect on some of the bacteria that might be problematic. And there's another mechanism which we could talk about. I think gut bacteria sometimes are overrated on some of the mechanisms, but I think there's an aspect called endotoxin. Now, endotoxin, again, is a potent producer of serotonin and often histamine as well. And when we get these kind of neurotransmitters that are quite high, they will create more irritation. And serotonin has a reverse effect on depending on which area of the bowel it is, because it makes one area hypercontract, another loosen off. And so sometimes we can see these issues relating to kind of constipation to very, very loose stools. So I think that's something we need to look at as well. And endotoxin, if you're eating lots of foods that are causing an issue, and sometimes when we talk about intestinal hyperpermeability, which isn't, let's just say, within standard medical protocol, it's not actually that looked at. It's not looked at as a real specific issue yet. In the more alternative integrative medicine and functional medicine, there's a real emphasis on the concept of leaky gut. But if endotoxin is able to permeate the bowel, it can create a huge amount of issues. And there's plenty of research to show that excesses of endotoxin are very problematic in many species.
We will talk more on this, diet and nutrition. You mentioned leaky gut. I want to come back on that. But we were talking before just about water and excess of water. Someone's texting asking, is it okay to drink water when you're eating? So with a meal, would you recommend that or not?
Well, the argument is that you're diluting the food and you're basically having to produce a little bit more stomach acid than you should do to break down the food. Remember, the stomach is there for really, its main function is to, one, produce enough stomach acid to sanitize all the food that's coming in, to produce enough acid to break down the nutrients and be the precursor for when it enters the small intestine, you have many more enzymes that go to work on the food. So the argument from the acidity perspective is that maybe you don't want to be having anything right with the food, having a few sips here and there, but flooding yourself again with lots of water when you're trying to break down food may be one of the reasons why you're getting particularly bloated during your food. But having a little bit beforehand, certainly afterwards, is probably the ideal with that. But again, I don't think that the research is really clear on it, but from what I see with lots of clients, when you're eating food and you're having some other drinks around that time, you don't need to necessarily have lots of water with your food, for sure.
Okay, and Michael's just texting saying, can your stomach be the cause of a migraine? We'll answer that when we come back. Keith Littlewood's here. He's a rehabilitation and performance coach based at Happy in Alsacal Avenue. So if you're in pain, if you maybe have a recurring injury that is causing you pain, do text in. Keith's here to help. He helps people with mobility issues as well as issues with the gut, your gut health and digestion. One here from Michael saying, can your stomach be the cause of a migraine? So issues in the gut, could that cause a migraine?
It depends. there's a lot of things, not so much probably the stomach, but certainly the small and large intestine, depending on a number of factors. Again, certainly when we don't go to toilet on a regular basis, let's say you have mild constipation, and when I say mild constipation, I mean not going to toilet every single day. So if you miss a day, you have a certain amount, I hate to use the word toxins, but there it is, you have a certain amount of metabolites that your body's trying to get rid of. Now when you're constipated, if they sit in the bowel, what tends to happen is they go back into the bloodstream, sometimes taken back up to the liver for another process to get rid of more metabolites. And so this can have an issue. Sometimes when there are issues related to kind of real-time problems with food, like allergies and things like that, we may see an issue with that. We know there's some feedback issues with kind of vagus nerve and other nerves that might...
the vagus nerve?
Well, vagus nerve is one of the big nerves that comes out of the brain and feeds a lot of the digestive and mainly all of the organs in the body. So there can be some issues with that. Certainly there can be, I think the food issue, but you know, headaches are multifactorial. We see a lot of headaches in women who tend to have an excess of estrogen, for example. We can see it in people with jaw issues and neck issues. We can see it within stress issues, which might be a combination of both of those. So, you know, I think it's multifactorial, and posture has been implicated to a degree in headaches as well. And that's there's certainly a number of things that we'd want to look at and clear before we say yes, it's the stomach that's driving that, or the digestive system. So it's certainly possible.
Okay, what about red meat? I'm looking here at an article out of the UK. Opt for red meat in your 20s, whole grains in your 30s, and colours are key in your 40s and 50s. Now, this is an interesting article. It's a light read, but it's basically talking about age and what you should be incorporating into your diet or not through the years. First off, red meat's got a bad rap. I know you like your meat, Keith. You like a good steak. There's often a lot of the C word associated with red meat, cancer. What do you think?
Well, there's an awful lot of C words associated with some vegetables as well, and that's very clear in a lot of the literature, that if in areas where they consume a certain amount of lots of brassica vegetables, there are high incidences of cancer. So we have to take it in context. I actually don't think, I think the prop there are several problems with eating meat that might be an issue, but they're probably not the dominant factor. If you're eating animals that are raised in very stressed environments, you know, perhaps not free range, not eating the foods that they're supposed to be eating, cows are supposed to eat grass. That's pretty much, if you get them eating maize and corn and you go for those kind of marble cuts with, you know, the fancier cuts, they're eating foods that they're not supposed to be eating. So a lot of cows also fed on soy these days, and that has a particular influence on the quality of the meat that you see. Other areas might be the amount of iron that you consume, and we know that when you consume an excess of anything, but particularly metals, it has a detrimental effect on how our cells function. And iron is a potent kind of, it has a capacity to shut down how our cells function, so that might be an issue. One of the most interesting papers that I've seen over the last few years is that it was the combination of an excess of iron and a lack of glycine may pose a problem with meat. So we're talking about not eating the whole animal. Now, that's kind of almost getting rid of these days, because it's very trendy to eat bone broth. Now, bone broth has a number of essential amino acids that you don't get enough of when you consume muscle meats. And this also comes back to what we were talking about bowel irritation, is that when you consume too many muscle meats that contain tryptophan, then that is very, very problematic. And tryptophan is the precursor to serotonin. So when you get high levels of that and some of the other lack of some of the other nutrients like glycine, proline, then we can see issues related to where problems might occur. But if you go to a lion, and a cat physiology is very different to human physiology to a degree, but it's, you know, we can see certain a number of similarities within a biological system. We have mitochondria, we have very similar systems. The digestive system sometimes is slightly different, but what you'll tend to see is that animals like lions don't have issues with cholesterol. You know, they don't get cancer from eating red meat. But there can be some issues associated with consuming a lot of red meat, not having the nutrients that balance out those particular issues. Perhaps if you're consuming too much iron from eating red meat, if you don't have a good digestive system and you're constipated and you have a bunch of red meat sitting in your bowel, that can be a problem. Most ammonia from high protein diets tends to be passed out. But when you have issues like this, and this is where context is key, if your digestive system is not working effectively, this is where we might tend to see a few metabolites sitting around that shouldn't be there.
Wow, it is a science, isn't it? It really is. But interesting also just to get into that science sometimes and really understand all the elements. You know, again, it's also what else you're eating, what your lifestyle is, in, you know, alongside that. And we've talked many times on the show about how does it make you feel when you've eaten a certain food. If you feel good, that's a good sign, right? If you're not feeling so good, then maybe cut it out or not eat so much of it, or look at what else you're eating around it.
And it's also difficult to tell with that, because something that you might eat might have its effects over 2 or 3 days. You might feel rubbish the next day and you have no idea sometimes. But if you kind of, you can, you know, I think recording a food diary and looking at some of those issues that might cause that can be particularly helpful for some people.
Yeah. Just to run this by you quickly, it is a light article, it's a light read, but I'd be interested to get your thoughts, Keith. So dietitians believe if you eat for your age, you can help to reduce weight gain. So according to Australian dietitian Tyson Tripconi, iron is important in your 20s, therefore you should make sure you get plenty of red meat, nuts and legumes. Once you're in your 30s, if you're a woman, you need to focus on whole grains. As a man, you need to think about reducing carbs and upping your veg intake. And in your 40s and 50s, a Mediterranean diet could be a good option for your health.
Sure, that's his point of view. I mean, I think it's riddled
with... If only it was that easy.
It's riddled with inaccuracies to say that each kind of decade. I mean, I think the important thing is eating a relatively balanced diet. You know, carbohydrates are essential within the diet for me. Some people will totally disagree with me, but the more that you kind of shy away from having adequate carbohydrates in. But you're talking about having lots of iron in your 20s. Why?
Yeah.
You need a balance of iron. Iron is essential to a degree. Like most other nutrients have a capacity for being essential if you have a deficiency of them. So it's interesting. You know, the Mediterranean diet is a great diet. I think some of the things that are missed out with the Mediterranean diet, if they have been particularly studied previously in countries that have a lot of sun, it might be vitamin D that's the protective factor.
And when you say Mediterranean diet, we're saying sort of fish.
They talk about, you know, fish, and there are grains, and there are plenty of fruits and vegetables. And I think these are the protective effects, some of the perhaps the fruits and the vegetables and good quality proteins, dairy as well. I think dairy can be, if you want to use the concept of a superfood, I've always thought that dairy is. Sometimes we get too wrapped up on the minuscule micronutrients that we have, and one of the primary things we have to have is energy. And if you don't have eat enough food, this is where the paradox lies. Are we looking at someone who's not eating enough, or are we looking at someone perhaps that's eating too much? And there's no doubt that eating too much and under eating both have negative effects on a different continuum.
One of the things it says here is eating things like tofu or soya, and there's a lot of confusion about soy and those kind of products as to being good for you or not good for you, particularly as a woman. They're recommending this in your 20s, but at any age. Can you clear up for me at all about soy and what, with regards to its makeup, as in, you know, it's good for what in
sure.
your diet?
I personally, and this is my opinion, I think the concept of eating plenty of phytoestrogens is probably one of the worst things that a woman can do, because you have two different factors, and for guys as well. I've certainly seen papers where someone eating extensively soy diet, a male, was exposed to gynecomastia, which is the incidence of breasts in men. They're pretty small incidences. The concept of the postmenopausal estrogen loss is very overrated, and there is research after research to show there are plenty of postmenopausal women who suffer from estrogen excess. And I was talking to you earlier about a study where they found a certainly significant relationship between the incidence of thyroid nodules and uterine fibroids. So I think the concept of eating foods that have phytoestrogens in is totally overblown, and the credibility within the science is also overblown as well. And soy, I think eating things like fermented soy does remove some of the potent compounds out of it. So soy sauce, natto, tempeh, I think are credible to eat for sure. But eating lots of tofu, I think I don't think is... I think in moderation you're probably going to be fine, but saying you need it in the diet on a daily basis is going to cause problems for a lot of people. You will get somebody who will say totally different to me, but it's an area I've been researching endocrinology for some period of time, and these are my thoughts on the matter.
I believe congratulations are in order.
I have one more exam, but even if I do quite badly on it, I should still have a pretty good mark. So I've done okay on it over the last year.
So you've passed. I've
definitely passed. I just have one more exam that I have to hand in, and I will. It's the difference between getting a distinction and a merit. That's all.
Okay, and you will have passed in what?
Postgraduate diploma in endocrinology.
Excellent. So and it's tomorrow the last exam. Isn't
yeah,
it?
But I've still got to get the results, and I had to do that because I didn't have any a proper medical background as the same as a doctor. So now I go on to do my master's degree in endocrinology, but I'm taking 6 months off because the last year's killed me. So it's useful to have that background information behind me for sure.
I wonder if Keith Little would take supplements. We'll find out when we come back, because we are going to be getting to this discussion. A lot of articles out there, very confusing, it always is, but we're going to unpack it as best we can in the time that we've got today. We take vitamins, we take supplements because we think they're good for us. Could we be taking too many and actually doing our bodies harm? I mean, in one article here, and this is just one of many, vitamin supplements can increase the risk of cancer and heart disease. That's one headline. Vitamin supplements can increase risk of cancer and heart disease. We'll discuss this and more. And we're going to be looking at exercise as well. One of our listeners are texting here asking about their exercise regime and if it's too much. Exercising twice a day for 45 minutes, is that too much? We'll see what Keith thinks. And you, joining the conversation and share your thoughts. Maya is asking, exercising twice a day for 45 minutes, do you think that's too much?
Well, I'm not a trainer of any kind. I used to be a personal trainer many moons ago. But most of my trainer friends would tell you these days that, I mean, if you're training for specific body composition where you're trying to get very low levels of body fat and you want to push yourself into a hole, you're heading in the right direction. But most trainers I know will want to take on a client and train them well 3 times a week. And that's what, you know, so you can train 5 days a week. You need to get rest. Rest is the most important part of a training program sometimes.
They've just come back actually to say, I forgot to mention it's 5 days a week.
5 days a week. Well, I'd say that's excessive. Part of it is that you can argue is that I remember reading something once about the Hunza tribe, which is one of the most documented tribes for their longevity. And because they're up and moving all the time, and this is part of it, you could argue that getting up and doing something twice a day, like a training program, and then going, making sure you're getting plenty of steps in, is a useful thing to do. But if you're going to the gym twice a day, I remember an old saying that if you're in the gym more than an hour or a certain amount of time, you're just making friends. So that there's part of that that you need to consider. But it really does depend on what the person's goal are and what they're trying to achieve. But like I said, most of my PT friends who I know would probably still recommend 3 solid training sessions a week and be done with that.
45 minutes twice a day is...
Yeah, you're an hour and a half, so you're looking at what, you know... what's 5 times that? 5, 3, 25.
It's not my job to do the sums.
Exactly.
So it's my job to read the articles.
You're talking 25 plus hours.
Yeah.
Sorry, an hour and a half a day. Yeah. No, sorry.
Help him out, wherever you're going with that. My brain's into the article that I want
so
to read.
So bad, my maths, isn't it? I have been up since like 3:30 this morning.
It's getting earlier by the minute. Rhabdomyolysis. Tell me this. You can say this. You can't do the maths, but can you do the English?
Yeah. Rhabdomyolysis.
Thank you very much. The life-threatening condition affecting certain classes. It's mentioning spinning here, but this is an actual condition when you are over exercising, is that right?
Yeah, it's been quite prevalent within certain CrossFit communities where certain you've been pushed so hard. I think the process is breaking down lots of protein and it causes a lot of issues within the body, most notably the kidneys as well. So that's what happens when you push yourself really, really hard. So it's certainly a condition. It's really hard to, you have to push yourself quite hard. I mean, the incidence of, there's not excess amounts, but there are certain exercise modalities where that comes across.
Yeah, it says here, it's usually found in athletes, soldiers, people who have physically demanding jobs. But it is coming up and being noted, like you said, in CrossFit, in boot camps, Insanity, which is the program online. You know, you can put that on, you can just buy it, put it into your TV and do it at home on the screen, the big screen.
Okay.
Insanity. So it's a workout that you can do, and yep, spinning as well. Doctors have been
7.5 hours, by the way. I don't know why it took me that long
there
to
in
get
the end. We'll get there. It might not be in a linear order today, but we will get there in the end. They've seen this rise in rhabdo cases in the general population. Symptoms include feeling achy, wobbly, nauseous and in pain after an intense workout. Although it's very rare, we need to say this, we're not sharing these stories to scare you, it's very rare, but it can be fatal. It's caused by the muscle fibers having to work too hard, basically self-combusting and then releasing their toxic contents into the bloodstream. That's in layman's terms.
Yeah, but we can put this in another context as well. There was an opinion by a psychologist that came out recently that showed that men are increasingly suffer from body image issues, over-exercising, under-eating, and this kind of falls into this might not fall exactly into that kind of paradigm, but certainly where people are just constantly pushing themselves to achieve physical perfection, and sometimes they are just pushing them because they think that more is what you need to do. And that's not the case with. I mean, you look at the way that athletes train as well. They go through a specific period throughout the year. There's plenty of rest. They'll look to peak at a certain phase during the season. And, you know, it's important to get that rest. So if you are pushing yourself and you're training multiple times a day and you're not getting the results that you want, this is where you need to ask yourself, am I doing the right thing? And should I perhaps get the advice of someone who knows what they're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. How are you feeling after your workout? If you're working out 45 minutes twice a day for 5 days a week, how do you feel? Are you completely spent? Are you really, you know, aching? I mean, a little bit of pain, but not, you're not supposed to be feeling that. I mean, everyone's no pain, no gain, but that isn't the case anymore. It shouldn't be.
No, I mean, exercise, obviously you need a specific adaptation to that imposed demand, which is the said principle, and you know, you need to be able to push yourself to get some gains, but at the same time there's no need to collapse on the floor. There aren't these reasons for that. You know, I think with the incidents or the kind of the, you know, the rise of CrossFit, we see a lot of issues occurring because there's that ethos that you have to push yourself and it's all within a group environment, but that's not necessarily, you know, conducive to the best type of training. And it certainly doesn't equate to we found that people that who tend to train using those modalities when they're an athlete, it actually decreases their performance in some levels.
What's interesting here as well, and you mentioned earlier about the effect on the liver when it comes to certain foods that you might be digesting and processing, or supplements, which we're going to get to. Here it's saying about this condition, rhabdo for short, that, you know, whilst all that process is happening, when you're overdoing it, it's actually being harmful to your kidneys. And sometimes we just don't think of that. We don't think about what's happening internally to our bodies, you know, in such a way, the organs are within our bodies. So let's move on to the vitamins and supplements. It's a big area, and we'll start it off before we go to the news. But, you know, I start off with the headline: vitamin supplements can increase risk of cancer and heart disease. That's rather alarming. Why vitamin pills don't work and may be bad for you. This is coming from BBC Science. This is a huge article. We'll do it in a kind of pre-seed line for you, but to give you a bit of background, and you were very familiar with this person, Linus Pauling.
Yes, Linus Pauling is he actually had the Linus Pauling Institute, which was I think it was more of a concept of orthomolecular medicine and looking at compounds and how they work within the body.
This is in the 1960s.
Yeah, and he was a champion of vitamin C. Now, vitamin C was actually found by a guy called Albert St. George, who actually won the Nobel Prize in 1936 for finding what is known as ascorbic acid or vitamin C. And Linus Pauling went on to champion the use of it. And I think in some of his therapies, they were kind of using like like mega doses of vitamin C, like 20,000 IUs. And I think that was also used in some alternative cancer therapies as well, but I can't remember the overall effects of it. But yeah, he was well known with the Linus Pauling Institute.
So according to this article, BBC Science, we dose up on antioxidants as if they are the elixir of life. At best, they are probably ineffective. At worst, they may just send you to an early grave, according to this. So Linus Pauling, as you said, it all started to go wrong when he changed his breakfast routine. In 1964, at the age of 65, he started adding vitamin C to his orange juice in the morning. It was like adding sugar to Coca-Cola, and he believed wholeheartedly, sometimes vehemently, that it was a good thing. Before this, his breakfasts were nothing to write about, just what that they happened early every morning before going to work at California Institute of Technology. Even on weekends, he was indefatigable, and his work was fruitful. At the age of 30, for instance, he proposed a third fundamental way that that atoms are held together in molecules, melding ideas from both chemistry and quantum mechanics. 20 years later, his work into how proteins, the building blocks of all life, are structured helped Francis Crick and James Watson decode the structure of DNA, the code of said building blocks. That was in 1953. The next year, Pauling was awarded a Nobel Prize in chemistry for his insights into how molecules are held together. An amazing guy. I mean, he's integral into our history of health and well-being, for sure. And we're not saying that vitamin C isn't good for you. However, we are going to share some more information and articles that are asking maybe to question the amount of vitamin C we're taking. And what about all those other vitamins? And do we need to be taking them all in supplement form?
Keith Littlewood,
who's a rehabilitation and performance coach based at Happy Dubai in Al Sakal Avenue. Here to take your questions 4001 or via the Messenger app for free. Any issues you might be facing when it comes to your digestion or gut health, as well as any injuries, pain, if you've got issues with mobility at all, any part of the body, Keith can help you today. That's the numbers. Get involved in the conversation. Lots of you texting in regarding supplementation, and we were just teasing you before we went to the news there about possibly our overuse of supplementation. Now, I was talking about Linus Pauling, who was one of our most influential scientists when it comes to the work he did on antioxidants. This article coming out of the UK's BBC Science is saying his belief in the power of antioxidants may have set us down a dangerous path. Vitamin C. Remember the vitamin C days? In his 1970 best-selling book, How to Live Longer and Feel Better, Pauling argued that such supplementation could cure the common cold. He consumed 18,000 milligrams, like 18 grams of the stuff per day. So times the recommended, 50 times the recommended daily allowance. In the book's second edition, he added flu to the list of easy fixes. When HIV spread in the US during the 1980s, he claimed that vitamin C could cure that too. In 1992, his ideas were featured on the cover of Time magazine under the headline The Real Power of Vitamins. They were touted as treatments for cardiovascular diseases, cataracts, and even cancer. Even more provocative are glimmerings that vitamins can stave off the normal ravages of aging, the article claimed. Sales in multivitamins and other dietary supplements boomed, as did Pauling's fame. Now, we're focusing on Pauling, but he's not alone, and it is a huge business. And, you know, if you feel good on it, then that's great, I guess. But it is interesting, and it certainly opened my eyes doing the research over the last few days and seeing how many articles are out there disclaiming the fact that actually multivitamins might be doing us good, and in some cases even suggesting they could be doing us harm. What do you think, Keith?
Well, again, if you look at the research, there's certainly windows where we need a certain amount of nutrients. Let's take vitamin D for example. Vitamin D seems to have heart protective capability at a certain level. When we're deficient, we tend to lose it. And vitamin D, you know, sometimes termed the sunlight nutrient, is very, very useful. It seems to have some wonderful actions on the immune system, anti-cancer, effective against some cardiovascular disease. And there's a window that if we have the right amount, but that window tends to lose when we super supplement. We also have to take into account somebody's ability to metabolize nutrients. Somebody with a sluggish liver, for example, we see like maybe in fatty liver. If you give them, which is sometimes commonplace, a large dose of vitamin D, say 50,000 IUs in one sitting or 100,000, then you might have issues with that. Sometimes as well, when we take super doses of nutrients, we sometimes disrupt what's called the redox potential, where we have the capability for the body to kind of take these compounds and interact and provide the, what might be the anti-inflammatory cascade by modulating the immune system. And high doses, when they oxidize, might actually be problematic. There's also the aspect of when you're taking a nutrient in isolation, say within a supplement, you're not getting the effect that you get with the whole nutrient, like say the polyphenols you might get from having a glass of orange juice, or the vitamin C working with the polyphenols, or other aspects. And often some of the supplements are actually kind of filled up with kind of issues that might give us some kind of irritation in some area of the body anyway.
Yeah, because so they're made of
magnesium stearate and other fillers, and you know, all of these additional fillers might be a problem. You're trying to say, well, here, take this nutrient, but don't worry about the other stuff that's in it.
And so it's like we say with food, read the labels of what your supplements are made of.
Yeah, but even with food, for example, we get wrapped up on saying, well, we need to eat this because it's got lots of vitamin E in it. But there's a reason it has lots of vitamin E in there. It's because it stops certain fatty acids going rancid. So, and it's a bit like going back to the meat debate we were talking about earlier on, where they found a specific nutrient called 5-3-SU12529 or whatever it is that might be implicated in cancer. But if you went to, say, a head of broccoli, you might find the same nutrient when you look at down at specific very, very micronutrient aspects of that particular food. So we need to take it in context. I think eating a diet which has plenty of organic fruit and vegetables, and the reason why I say organic, having food sprayed with lots of pesticides does have an effect on living tissue, hence why it kills other organisms. So I think having the least amount of chemicals in the food is a good thing that we should be doing, and I think organic farming should be something that we should be able to aspire to. Now the arguments behind that are obviously different because of the amount of foods that we produce, and there are various other arguments behind the companies that produce those pesticides that might have an influence. At the same time, with nutrients, for example, there probably can be in some cases where we need slightly more nutrients. For example, I'm fair-headed and I get in the sun a reasonable amount. I try and get in the sun every day. But because I'm fair-skinned, when I take on board ultraviolet rays and vitamin D, I burn through excess amounts of vitamin A. And whereas I've used kind of personally on my skin sometimes in excess of 60,000-70,000 IUs, which is like, you know, 100 times more than what we should be taking. So RDAs as such, there's a huge variation in someone's RDAs depending on how their system functions. And I think I mentioned this before, there's a book from the 60s called Biochemical Individuality, where we see that people go through different nutrients at very different rates. And so to say that all these blood tests and all of these kind of tests that are accurate, we don't have a proper understanding of all of the variations of what somebody's systems go through and what they actually need.
Mm. And I think to add to that, if you sort of keep in simple terms, why are we taking them? We take them because maybe we are conscious that our lifestyle's not so great. So if I go and take that supplement, because I'm making up for that, maybe I'm thinking I'm not getting as many fruit and vegetables as I should be getting into my diet because I'm busy, or because I don't think they're very, you know, the fruits and vegetables are very nutrient high, maybe because it's all been imported in. So I'll go and take a supplement. And it might be fine to do that. I'm not saying don't do that. But I think if we're always quick to reach for, and it's in the word, it's in the name, it's a supplement, when actually we should be doing what is natural, which is in our food first, utmost and foremost, get what we need from our food, it's there, rather than taking something that's been manufactured for us. However, I take supplements because I know I've got some deficiencies, and so I'm taking those certain prescribed supplements, I must add, by the way. I didn't pick it up for myself, to help me with that. So, you know, it's about taking it seriously and not just thinking I can grab from the pharmacy that multivitamin pack and that will sort of let me off all of that, those bad habits or those bad practices, if that's the case.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that I would say is a criticism that I see a lot of people who've seen other practitioners, and they've given them a new diet and a supplement schedule of 10 to 15 supplements. It's like, you've got to see what the diet does first of all. If you've changed someone from eating a diet that's kind of high in really, really refined foods, cooked in vegetable oils, mass produced, a variety of factors, and you're giving them a diet that's very, very different, See what that works like, first of all, instead of represent, you know, trying to give them 10, 15 other supplements as well, because otherwise you just might end up just giving them very expensive urine.
Yeah, right. Right?
So we've got to kind of take everything at the value that it's at and see what changes that we can make with specific treatments. And changing someone's diet to start with can be very, very productive.
Yeah, you can really see some differences. Just quickly, let me share this with you, and I'm going to get to your messages coming in. Effects from taking large doses of vitamin and mineral supplements. This is by Lisa Sefcik. She's been writing since 1987 on health and wellness subjects. She's a freelance writer and columnist from Cox Publications. Vitamins and minerals may seem harmless when taken in pill form. These are classified by the US Food and Drug Administration as dietary supplements. However, taking mega doses of vitamin and mineral supplements usually isn't necessary if you're in good general health. In some cases, this can cause ill effects and compromise your health. According to Harvard Medical School, more than half of the Americans taking vitamin and mineral supplements, there's very little research that shows these are beneficial to their health, even when taken in regular doses. The only exceptions to the rule may be fish oil and vitamin D supplements, says Harvard. If your diet includes an abundance of vegetables, fruits, nuts, whole grain foods and fish, you're likely to get the essential nutrients that you need. Some people may choose to take a multivitamin as a fallback. However, taking large doses of a vitamin or mineral can lead to adverse side effects and health consequences. It's a long article, but it makes a lot of sense to me anyway. And it talks about how it's affecting the body when it, you know, internally. But let me just quickly share this with you, because you've touched on it as well, Keith. According to Baylor College of Medicine, water-soluble vitamins usually aren't problematic when taken in large doses, as these are flushed from the body through the kidneys. However, the fat-soluble vitamins A, D, E, and K could be problematic. Too much vitamin A or beta-carotene is associated with an increased risk of certain cancers and other health problems in people who smoke, who are exposed to asbestos. Vitamin D deficiency can cause a condition called hypercalcemia, in which too much calcium is released into the blood, according to the Mayo Clinic. And nausea and vomiting, constipation, weakness and confusion are some symptoms associated with vitamin D toxicity. When taken in large amounts, vitamin E is associated with stroke and premature death. So water-soluble vitamins such as vitamin C may not be as dangerous. However, taking mega doses of it isn't beneficial. A February 2006 National Public Radio report described taking large quantities of vitamin C for colds as one of the greatest hoaxes ever played on the American public.
Well, I mean, we could even say there's lots of inaccuracies in those particular statements that have just been made. I mean, for example, vitamin E, there's plenty of research that show that adequate vitamin E within the diet is a very potent antioxidant that does do some good. If we look at things like vitamin K, for example, vitamin K1 and we have K2. Vitamin K2 is one of the primary reasons that it makes sure that calcium is supposed to go to the places where it's supposed to go to. I mean, if you have too much vitamin D, for example, and you don't have enough calcium in the diet, one of the things that you're going to do is increase the amount of parathyroid hormone and leach calcium from the bones. You'll resorb the calcium because there's an excess of vitamin D sometimes. So there can be, again, it is person specific sometimes, but the fat soluble vitamins do get a bit of a bad rap. Now, if there are issues where you have an accumulation of body fat or you have an inability to utilize the nutrients effectively, that can be the case. But sometimes a lot of people are actually vitamin A deficient, which, and vitamin A is integral in thyroid function as well. So every person who has a different issue going on will have different factors of why those nutrients are either causing problems or there is deficiency that might be causing problems as well.
So it kind of begs the question whether we should actually be going and getting prescribed supplements as opposed to we are supplementing ourselves because we're taking that multivitamin, but we don't know what's going on in our bodies. And as we always say, everybody's different and you might have different issues.
Yeah, and a lot of people kind of are going down the bandwagon of genomic testing and looking at genes and how much nutrients you actually need, and can we actually kind of write a schedule that's specific to you. And yeah, you know what, you probably can do that, but then those genes are going to change somewhat. Epigenetics, you're going to express genes very, very differently. Usually we bring into the world acquired damage from our parents sometimes, or stronger, kind of more robust kind of genetic profiles. But I kind of think that there are many things that the environment that are going to change how we express ourselves, which might mean that then your schedule within the space of a few weeks might be totally different, or might be totally different over a year. You just don't know. I would rather go down the route of, for people to actually feel good about themselves and feel good about the foods that they're eating, is eat a good diet that you know, make sure your energy needs are met, look at aspects of if you're sleeping okay, your energy's okay, look at all these other factors, because they're kind of factors of whether you're actually getting it right or not. But otherwise we've got everybody going down the route of trying to get tested and say, oh, my nutrient schedule's not right for me, and it kind of creates a lot of neuroticism around supplements and food again.
Well, let me know what you think, and we've got lots of questions to answer. The University of Colorado study was presented to the American Association for Cancer Research. Dietary supplements such as over-the-counter multivitamins do more harm than good and can increase the risk of developing cancer and heart disease, according to research in the US. This is from 2015. I'm sharing that because just wanted to add that Professor Tim Byers, Associate Director for Cancer Prevention at the University's Cancer Center, says, at the end of the day, no substitute for good nutritional food. Stay with us. One here. Should postmenopausal women take calcium and vitamin D combined? Thanks for an interesting program once again. Thank you very much.
That's the issue for osteoporosis prevention. And this, again, there's a subtopic on this, if you want to go into it, is that if you look at a lot of the standard endocrine textbooks, they look at the incidence of the loss of estrogen. And we can see that in postmenopausal women, in some studies, 50% of women have an excess of estrogen still. But if you look at the actions of the hormone progesterone, that actually helps to build bone tissue up. It's called bone trophic. So there's an action there. Regarding vitamin D and calcium, I think that if you have a diet that's rich in calcium from good dairy products and you're in the sunshine, there's very little need to. And that's because the supplements, they come again with that little additives here and there, but there's nothing like sunlight and milk or ice cream or cheese that's going to have the same effect. So I would rather somebody go down that. If you can't be bothered to get that in your system, or you don't like those foods, then yes, it will be helpful.
Yeah, if you don't respond well to those foods,
there's a certain. But again, if you're lacking some, hormones like progesterone, for example, your ability. All estrogen does, it doesn't build bone up; it prevents the resorption. That means it stops the calcium being leached out further to a degree. But there are other hormones like prolactin, which might have a role in also further decreasing the amount of calcium in the bone as well.
But don't dairy products carry estrogen? I mean, if you're estrogen high, should you be eating that much dairy?
I think some of the research that I've looked at is that that it's usually because it goes through the digestive tract, it's usually taken out to a degree. And again, there's a really interesting study, I may have mentioned this before, they found that they compared rural Mongolian women with city-dwelling Mongolian women and city-dwelling UK women. And they found that the higher levels of progesterone, despite eating vast amounts of meat and dairy, which it's, if you're going down the route of sort of saying that's a problem, which I don't think it is, were very, very protective against kind of disease states. So what was the original question?
So no, I was just thinking, because you're saying, you know, you could eat dairy, take dairy rather than take a supplement, you'll get your calcium that way. But if you're also talking about 50% of women that are postmenopausal might have high estrogen you get from dairy.
Yeah, but I mean, if you kind of cheese and butter type formats, I don't think it's going to be an issue at all. So if you're drinking copious amounts of milk, perhaps, but I think from what I've seen, it's not really too much of a problem.
Okay. Interesting though, isn't it?
Yes, of course.
And it's all those connections. And just coming back on the Mongolian women, so you're saying, I'm assuming that the rural Mongolian woman came out well.
But produced a lot more progesterone, and that was the protective factor. And we, again, with women's health and postmenopausal issues, if you look at the data and the research, you'll find kind of statements like progesterone, the most potent endometrial protector. You'll see that when there's excesses of estrogen around endometrial tissue, you'll get issues like uterine fibroids, PCOS is implicated with high levels of estrogen, and other aspects, but other kind of issues around that area is high states of estrogen are problematic.
Where can you get the progesterone from?
Well, there are doctors that do compounding pharmacies here that do it, and you can definitely get it from other places as well.
Right, but you wouldn't get it through food.
You can. But brains have a high concentration of progesterone. Being in the sunlight, you can produce a lot of progesterone.
Okay.
If you have sunlight on skin and long days with sunny days, if you're out, you produce a lot more progesterone than not.
Question here. I have low CO enzyme Q10 and a slight anemia, but thyroid B and D vitamins are okay. What could be causing this? Adrenal fatigue has been suggested.
Don't know what the diet's like. I think adrenal fatigue is sometimes a kind of sort of a diagnosis that's thrown about, but there are many aspects of why that might be there. Sometimes diet is a huge issue. Sometimes there are environmental stimulants that might cause that as well, but if you've been tested, it depends on somebody tests the concept of adrenal fatigue, and the way that people test it, I don't think it's very valid sometimes. So I think you need to look at diet first of all. Because we don't have any idea of what this person's diet is like, it's really hard to make an assumption. But anemia can come from a bunch of things, and again, we're going on a specific marker of whether that iron's actually, you know, doing the thing that it should do within that reference range.
Okay. I think you just need to explore more. You must have done quite a lot of exploration to get those specifics. But interesting there. I was going to try and dissect that, but I shouldn't really. I just think it's interesting if you're saying that your thyroid and B and D vitamins are fine, but adrenal fatigue has been suggested, because that's about energy, isn't it? And one would imagine then if they weren't fine, you might have the adrenal fatigue.
Yeah, there's lots of in it. Just because you have BD and thyroid might be okay. Depends how the thyroid's been looked at. I mean, a lot of people look at thyroid by assessing one blood test, which is the incidence of TSH. And there can be many other factors that might make the TSH not a good place to start with that. So with thyroid, you'd want to look at things like, do you get cold hands, cold feet, thinning of hair, constipation, all of these kind of things, low energy. These are suggestive of thyroid issues as well. And there are other markers that you can look at with that, T3 and T4. Some people look at them in the free hormone concept. So there's a lot of things to consider, and it's really hard to say when someone might text in and say, look, we've looked at these three things. What could this be doing? Because it could be so much stuff. And you need to look at history. You need to look at food intake. You need to look at kind of emotional kind of issues within a person as well. There can be so many things that you need to look at. Even pain and movement-based stuff can create hormonal issues as well.
Stress in there as too.
With stress, if you have increased pain, you probably produce more stress hormones. Now, anytime when you increase the stress hormones like cortisol, that has, in fact, interestingly enough, it has a knock-on effect to both thyroid, because it inhibits thyroid production, and within women as well. But I say women because progesterone, believe it or not, is actually a male and a female hormone. It's just you tend to see more of it within females. But progesterone should have enough progesterone binding to the progesterone receptor. In times of stress, whether that's not eating enough, not having enough food, over-exercising, all of these kind of things, is that cortisol and glucose will be taken to the progesterone receptor. So this is why a lot of women sometimes that you see, that the state that might be related, say, you see a lot of conditions related to anorexia because of people and their impact on hormones and fertility, or other eating issues, and even missing meals on a regular basis and being generally stressed out can have the same issue that will impact on the ability to get pregnant or maintain pregnancy, because when progesterone isn't produced, it's really hard for the integrity of the baby to be maintained throughout the pregnancy.
There's a lot to this. We've got some information about fertility. We'll get to that when we come back, and more of your messages. Justin saying, is breakfast mandatory or a fad created by the big cereal companies? I don't know if you only can have cereal for breakfast, but are you a believer in breakfast?
Well, look, people should be able to... If you look at an evolutionary perspective, there'll be plenty of times when we had to skip breakfast, when we were being chased by a tribe of whoever, or, you know, being chased by a saber-toothed tiger. We probably would have had to miss breakfast. Evolutionary, I think some of our bodies have actually turned down a bit. Our liver doesn't probably have the same capacity to store carbohydrates effectively, or, you know, our capacity to stay balanced. If you have a body where you struggle to get good sleep, you have struggled to get good energy, if you have issues with fertility or PMS, for example, in the female, if you have poor digestion, poor emotional balance, this is probably saying to you that if you're skipping breakfast and you're not eating in an appropriate manner, then probably skipping breakfast isn't great for you. If you have a good system where all of those things are working well, and you can probably even go to the gym and work out on an empty stomach. But bear in mind, most people in the morning have usually fasted 12 hours or so, or maybe 10 hours. That means you've depleted most of your glucose from your liver, and you're heading towards a state where you need to produce more stress hormones. So bear in mind, cortisol starts increasing about 2 a.m. in the morning and then gradually increases up, and by 12 p.m. should start actually coming down again. The problem is that will dictate how much cortisol you're producing based upon how much energy you have left in your liver. So if you're skipping breakfast, and most people start to skip breakfast when they're stressed because they don't feel hungry. Why? Because they're producing the stress hormones that are saying, you don't need to feed me, you're stressed, you're running around on a stress system. So it's really important to understand whether that person has the capacity to skip breakfast, or whether they're experiencing those symptoms that are suggestive, actually you probably do need something like a glass of juice and a piece of cheese or something like that just to get you onto when you have food next. So it's important that when these people experience these issues, that they have something just to balance their blood sugar levels out.
Yeah, and feel them. I've got Keith Littlewood here. He is a rehabilitation and performance coach based at Happy Dubai in Al Sakal Avenue. Go and check it out. And if you want to get your broth, you can get that as well there, can't you?
Yeah. It's cracking ice cream at the moment, like organic coffee ice cream.
Oh, really?
Yeah, covered in chocolate.
That's not made by Keith. That's Paul.
No, it's not. It's not my area of expertise. Paul Frangie's doing some great things down there.
Yeah, but he is making the broth, so you can get that.
Yeah, he's got his team churning out the broth.
Yeah, so it's beef, chicken, lamb.
Yeah, I think they've even got a mushroom broth as well.
Oh, okay,
now. Or a vegetable broth as
okay,
well.
Okay, good.
Doesn't have the same qualities, of course.
According to Keith, but you know.
Yeah.
We've been talking about all manner of things, as always. We've been looking at the things that maybe we do too much of. We think we're being healthy. We do it because we think it's good for us, but we could be doing harm. And just understanding more about that, so we've gone through supplementation and vitamins, exercising, even water. All of these things are good for us, but it's about understanding why we're taking them and how much, or why we're doing it and how much we're doing of it. Lots of messages coming in. We're addressing them. The other area that Keith also helps people with is pain and mobility. Someone's texted in here to say, I've got pain and stiffness in my knees just before I work out. I'm fine during the run or when I'm working out, but it's before that. Why is it?
Well, there's a couple of simple factors. It might be, one is that you might warm up appropriately. And sometimes that when we move, say, getting, you know, out of our chair to stand up, or we start moving slow, sometimes that we don't notice, we do notice the pain in those slower movements. So when we start running, the threshold for experiencing pain or stiffness isn't there. Plus our tissues tend to warm up. We become more, as you just said, lotion is motion, which I think is always a great, great one to use. But a good warm up and that will usually get rid of that. So, but yeah, sometimes it's the speed of the motion that creates that response.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it? And I think you know, often people when they feel pain will think, I won't do anything.
Yeah.
And that actually that might be what you need to do, but it also could be the wrong thing to do. Sometimes actually moving will help the body.
Yeah, it goes counter to the old advice that where you used to say, oh, you've got back pain, go and stay a week in bed, which actually atrophies all the muscles that were working. So we know that with pain, sometimes pain is a funny one. Sometimes it's there because there's literally a feedback issue. The body's communicating in a way that doesn't resolve the issue. Sometimes it's tissue tolerance. Sometimes it's just we've got too many muscles working in a certain way that creates this kind of issue. And sometimes it's actually old pain that's left over from old injuries. Sometimes it's emotional triggers to pain. And so we've got to try and find a way that kind of creates the change that and that can come about really quickly sometimes. But laying in bed and detraining all the muscles that were there originally is not the best place to go. Being able to go through graded movements that kind of actually allow you to experience movement and realize it's not such a threat, because people get bogged down in the threat of the pain coming back. And there can be a number of triggers why that happens. Could be an old injury, can be just the thought of something. So it's often just getting the person to experience the ease of motion they can get, and not being worried about that particular movement and going into it.
Someone asking here about the keto diet is, what do you think of this if done in moderation?
Well, again, it's like context is key, and sometimes we talk about the keto diet, it's basically a high fat diet. I personally think a high fat diet for most people is stressful. You can see pretty good gains in the short term for a lot of people. You might see, because you're, sometimes it's loss of carbohydrate within the liver that you lose weight. There can be weight loss. Some people can feel okay, some people can feel absolutely awful. And the thing is, what you've got to look at a specific diet is all the things that I talk about from a common sense perspective. When you're on that diet, do you have good sleep, good energy, good digestion, good libido is a great marker, good emotional balance, and an absence of pain? And these are the markers that you need to think about whether a diet's working for you. If you're not sleeping, it's probably not a good idea, because you're not, you don't have adequate enough energy to get through the night. And those with more stress metabolism will experience that more so. If you get cold hands and cold feet, or you lose the ability to think straight, these are other factors of whether that particular diet's working for you or not. Some people could probably go on it short term and get some really good responses, but I think maintaining a high fat diet for long periods of time can be stressful for a lot of people, particularly because you have to produce a lot more cortisol when you're using fat as a fuel. You also don't produce enough, as much carbon dioxide or water that when you use carbohydrate, and carbon dioxide is essential within the body to help it function effectively.
Alistair's asking about his knees. My knees click when walking upstairs. It doesn't hurt, but I worry it's doing damage.
Well, it might be a number of things. You need to think about previous injuries, anything where you think about system. What are the things that's happened to that person in the past? It might be instability. Sometimes we get this clicking because the structures aren't in their most optimal position and they rub over certain structures. Sometimes it's just that's the way that their system has started to function. But so I would always think about, if there's lots of clicking going on, you're rubbing over a structure that shouldn't be being rubbed over, and you may want to look at an appropriate therapy or movement strategy that gets rid of that.
And someone here saying, I've got high cholesterol, it's hereditary, there are hereditary reasons. Can I reverse it through working out and diet and with no medicine?
Yeah, I believe so. Look, there are a couple of factors with this. First of all, my opinion, and again, I'm not a doctor, I can't diagnose, there tends to be a little bit of misinformation sometimes within the medical community about what high cholesterol is caused by, and it's been shown time and time again. And if you go to the NHS website, they will corroborate my opinion on this. Your dietary cholesterol has very limited impact on how much cholesterol that you produce. Bear in mind that cholesterol is number one. It's a basic building block of tissue. It's also a powerful antioxidant as well. So if you want to go on cholesterol lowering medication, what are you doing? You're also taking away one of the most powerful antioxidants that you have. And that has impacts on CoQ10, which is heart protective, and magnesium, and how that's particularly produced. I think eating a diet that doesn't create inflammation, so if you're eating lots of fried food and vegetable oils, this kind of thing, that will create inflammation, which means you'll need to create more cholesterol. Exercise should help to lower cholesterol as well. So sometimes when we're in a state where we don't exercise at all or we eat lots of foods that help to create inflammation, that's when cholesterol elevates. Familial hypercholesterol certainly has what we might call a hereditary component. What we might need to consider with this, and this is something I've always toyed with, is if family have had an undiagnosed thyroid issue in the past, there are two main reasons why cholesterol is elevated. One is because you are hypothyroid. That means your ability to produce energy and how your cells function is not working appropriately, and therefore there tends to be more cholesterol produced. It's well known that when you supplement a hypothyroid person with adequate thyroid hormone, their cholesterol goes down to normal levels. There's also some people that the markers of hypercholesterolemia have come down significantly over the last 10 to 15 years, and that is an issue of why people are being suggested they have high cholesterol. I think the concepts of a good and bad cholesterol often misrepresented, because having high levels of the so-called good cholesterol is sometimes associated with autoimmune issues and cancer as well. So we need to be mindful of what cholesterol is actually telling us. But to answer the question is yes, a good diet and appropriate exercise, not excessive exercise, is conducive to having if somebody wants to call a cholesterol level normal.
And a diet that reduces inflammation and cortisol. So again, you want to be having your fresh foods, fresh veg,
yep.
fruit, salads, yep. Just keep getting as natural as you possibly can.
Just, yeah, to a degree. I mean, sometimes, you talk about the concept of natural, some foods, some in their most natural form are a disaster for some people.
But to reduce inflammation, you'd be...
Well, there are certain some compounds that may be useful. We talked about curcumin, which is useful.
Turmeric.
Yeah, but curcumin is the kind of base... turmeric is curcumin is found in turmeric, yes, for sure. And, orange juice, vitamin C, polyphenols and that are useful for anti-inflammation. There's a really good study that came out a few years ago that showed that when you drank orange juice and if you're eating a high-fat, high-carbohydrate meal, orange juice lessened the effects of the byproducts of an endotoxin. When we eat foods, we produce endotoxin. And excessive amounts, if you eat really fatty meals, you produce a lot of endotoxin. So having orange juice with a particular food might be useful. But here's another flip to it. If you drink a lot of orange juice and eat a lot of red meat, you're often going to absorb lots of iron. So sometimes there are, relationships with how nutrients are absorbed that need to be considered within the context of what a person needs.
Yeah, so the other way of looking at it, which you've already said, is avoid those inflammatory ingredients like your oils.
Oils, as in cooked oils, cooked very, oils, very inflammatory.
Yeah, processed foods.
Yeah. You can even argue, and I think I've talked about this before, sometimes when you're consuming a lot of grains that are fortified with lots of iron, if you're having an excess of iron, that can create inflammation within the bowel, as can eating lots of foods all the time. And if you're overeating, you can produce a lot of inflammation. If you're undereating, that can have some specific effects. But I think what we're talking about here is, can a good diet and exercise reverse high cholesterol, even from a hereditary perspective? Yes, because our genes can change. We can have certain influences that cause our system to function in a very different way.
So many questions coming in for you today, Keith. We'll do our best to get through them. Stay with us. Mahesh is saying, I work out regularly, try eating right and sleep on time, but I still don't get more than 1 hour of deep sleep at best. Should I worry about this, and are there ways to get more deep sleep? I should also mention that I've got IBS, but I try avoiding foods that trigger the IBS.
Try not to worry too much. That's always a good piece of advice I try and give clients. I think if you're not getting deep sleep, there are a couple of mechanisms that you need to look at why. And sometimes when you don't have enough carbohydrate in the diet, and I typically see this in people who are doing that, they're trying to eat healthy and exercise, but there's something that stimulates the release of a stress hormone that wakes them up, or it might be a neurotransmitter. If he has IBS and he's eating stuff that irritates his bowel, he's going to produce an excess of serotonin. Excess serotonin within the serum or the blood will cause you to wake up, because serotonin is a neurotransmitter of wakefulness. So trying to keep these kind of like histamine and which is another neurotransmitter of wakefulness, but with well known within irritation, right? We know our hay fever and antihistamines. So trying to have a diet that's low in these irritating foods, and nuts, seeds, kind of undercooked vegetables, and sometimes grains can be a real irritation to the digestive tract. And also making sure, sometimes with sleep, having a glass of milk with honey before sleep is a great way of trying to enter deep sleep. Some people are aware of this, of a compound called GABA, which is, again, in different parts of the brain, is very useful for helping enter into deep sleep. And also the pre-phase of what's called non-REM sleep. But the thing is that it's been shown that the brain uses just as much glucose in deep sleep as it does when it's awake. So if you have low blood sugar levels and you don't have enough sugar to support sleep, you're going to be woken up by stress hormones that are kind of encouraging you to wake up so you can start to liberate energy from stored fats. So we don't know what it's like with him at the moment, but it's a very common thing that I tend to see, is when somebody says they try to eat healthy and they're doing all the right things, sleep is a big indication of whether something's actually, you're doing that right, or if there's something deeper seated, perhaps a hormonal issue. Sometimes hypothyroid people don't sleep particularly well. Some people who produce too much cortisol don't sleep too well, but again, that could come easily back to the diet.
If you're saying have some carbohydrate, what would you recommend and when before sleep?
Well, I mean if somebody has a glass of milk with some gelatin, or the hydrolyzed bone broth, that's really good with some honey. So sugar and honey before sleep are really, really good. Even a glass of juice might be particularly useful for helping you to sleep. And some people sometimes orange juice for some people can irritate their digestive system. Sometimes it's great, but the idea of sustaining deep sleep is maintained sometimes by having adequate carbohydrate available. Milk and honey and with some gelatin is usually great. Sometimes a herbal tea with some gelatin and some honey in is also another good idea.
One here, my mum is 69 and she had a hip fracture and full kneecap replacement. Doctors say she will have limited mobility even after recovery. Anything we can do to assist or help her mobility?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes the scar, once that's actually healed, creates a lot of disruption about how parts of the body function. So having it a good, there'll probably be some physio that would be taken into consideration as part of the rehab process. Sometimes I do see lots of issues related to scars to big surgeries, and even small scars, as stretching the scar can create inhibition of certain muscles and cause ligaments to not function appropriately. So this, getting somebody who understands the scar once that's healed is a useful issue. Sometimes as well, if you've had ankle injuries in the past, this distorts how the knee and the hip function as well. I mean, the hip fracture is there from a number of issues, probably because perhaps low bone density and a number of other factors. But yeah, there's plenty that can be done from a dietary and from a movement and therapy perspective. Yeah.
Now, this is quite complex, Keith. Don't know if you can help with this. I was diagnosed with having high liver enzymes levels for more than 10 months now. I've been checked multiple times for viral infections, but nothing was detected. Ultrasound showed mild case of fatty liver, but the doctor says that it won't cause the increased liver enzymes. What could be the cause? I'm 38 years, I'm a male, weight is 89, height 178, very light alcohol consumption.
There can be a number of reasons why liver enzymes get elevated, and any doctor will tell you that there are certainly multiple cases of why this might happen. Sometimes there can even be viruses or things like very low grade infections that might cause liver enzymes to be off. Sometimes again, there are certain hormone issues that might be able to drive that as well if they're elevated. So sometimes we see that in a number of stress cases, and sometimes in a number of kind of issues related to energy function as well. So it's really difficult to say. There may even be something, there could be a subtle environmental pollutant that might be causing liver enzymes to go up as well.
The function of the liver, and I mean, we didn't get into it earlier, but we were talking about, I'm not relating this to this particular case, by the way, but it just made me think, we were talking earlier about vitamin supplementation, and if we overdose, if we mega dose on supplementation, it could have an impact on our liver. So just, it's a filter, isn't it? The liver acts as a filter for what we are digesting.
It's a filter, but it's also, you know, it's instrumental in how much energy we actually produce as well. So yes, it's used in the detoxification process, but bear in mind the skin, the lungs, the kidneys are all involved in detoxification process as well. So the liver has many, many functions. Sometimes when we see fatty liver infiltrations, we see compromised function of the liver from an energetic perspective. And we can certainly see this in kind of energetic states and perhaps thyroid-like states as well. So it's interesting to see within the person, is there a dietary issue, is there some environmental issues, is there a stress issue? All of these factors contribute to how someone's liver functions.
And a fatty liver, it comes about through what?
It can come around for a number of stuff. Some people have related to excess amounts of carbohydrate. I would say you could probably see that when you see someone's energetics or metabolism is off. People often cite the incidence of diabetes due to carbohydrates, but the problem is it's usually the insulin signaling and the receptivity to carbohydrate is lost. It's part of a stress reaction called the Randall cycle or the glucose fatty acid cycle. And when we have a stress system, we lose the ability to utilize carbohydrate as a fuel. And then sometimes we switch to oxidizing the fats as a fuel. And sometimes when the carbohydrate doesn't get used up, you may see extra carbohydrate in the liver. And the fats that create that will also be stored in the liver as well.
Also a question here regarding the jaw. So Rob says, my jaw gets locked when I yawn or open my mouth full. I've stopped chewing gum, which has made it a little better, but what might be the reason?
Yeah, I mean, the jaw is a big powerhouse of where we kind of create stability and movement within the neck, within jaw function. There can be congenital issues where issues related to the jaw are present from birth. Bear in mind, we have a disc in the jaw on each side, and sometimes when the disc is stretched forwards, that creates issues related to clicking instability. We have a number of muscles that are used to take the jaw from side to side, open and close. Even muscles up in the head sometimes have a significant impact on the jaw because they're used for closing. So sometimes when you've had problems with the neck, or even you could even perhaps say that ankle injuries can be a part of why the jaw tends to overcompensate sometimes in some chains of the body.
Fascinating, isn't it?
Yes.
Really amazing. We are just about out of time. I'm sorry if we didn't get to all your messages. So many coming in. But Keith will be back. And, of course, you can connect with Keith as well. He's based at Happy Dubai in Al Sakhal Avenue. And we put all his details up on our website today as well. He's also got his Facebook page. Body mind,
balanced body mind.
Balanced body mind. Get the B's in the right order. Balanced body mind. Yes. So lots of interesting information there as well. We were going to talk about fertility. We're going to talk about the environment and toxicity. We were going to talk about noise as well, being a pollutant, if you will. New research on that, but we ran out of time, so we'll save that for the next show when Keith is back in the chair. So that's it for now. Thank you, Keith. What are you up to next? You got your exam tomorrow.
I've got one more exam of my postgrad studies. I've got a presentation tomorrow that I'm delivering to an organization on biology of sleep, which I need more of myself. Kind of back into work after some studying and some travel abroad. So I'm here for a while before I shoot off again. And I'm teaching some courses throughout the year as well.
Fantastic. Well, we look forward to catching up with you again very soon.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.